The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia, New Jersey. Welcome to another issue of Inside Medicine every Saturday from 10 a.m. to 10:57 in 30 seconds. Please want everybody to know that we have a website up, www.wwdbam.com. You can hit Inside Medicine, and then you'll have access to over 75 shows. And if you want to get educated with your time off, hit that button, and you'll be in business. Today, I have a fantastic guest. That's a professor from the University of Pennsylvania, Dr. Mark Goldstein. Mark has been on the show before, an excellent guest. Always well prepared, always with lots of energy-packed information that he's going to send over. I just do want to start out with a little statement. Weight loss drugs are always in the news, and Amgen stock is up over 45% for the past year, driven by the excitement around the trials of its obesity drug, MariTide, which has started phase 3 trials. So it's not here yet, but the hubbub is starting to go. This drug only requires an injection once a month, and I've tried to look up the mechanism of action, have been a little bit short on getting the final indication of that. But to be able to get a weight loss drug that is once a month certainly has an advantage for a lot of people. It apparently has good durability, and hopefully we'll get another agent on the market. Right now we have two. Both are doing incredibly good, and we love it. These drugs have been proved to decrease stroke, decrease MI, prolong kidney function. A lot of things are, it's got a positivity. The only problem is the green cost is a little bit on the steep side. Of course, that's my opinion, but if you lose 100 pounds, it's always worth it. So, Mark, are you there?
I'm ready to go, Joe.
Hey, Mark, always a pleasure to have you. Mark is a full professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He hangs out at Ben Franklin's Hospital and also up 295, a little bit high of where we're living right now. But anyway, Mark is one of the best experts. He also talked about alpha-gal years ago when he was on the show. And I have to tell Mark that I saw a patient today, this week, who had lost about 50, 70 pounds just by getting the alpha-gal problem. The guy looked good but was sick as can be. So, Mark, let me just open up your area. How common are food allergies?
Well, Joe, first, let me just thank you for the introduction and having me back on the show. It's always a pleasure to speak with you, and I'm really excited to talk about selected topics in food allergy, and we'll talk at the end, hopefully, about a revolutionary treatment, much like what you just mentioned in regard to your field of obesity, a new FDA-approved drug used for treatment of food allergy. So I hope that we'll have a very fruitful discussion, no pun intended. But to answer your question, how common are food allergies? You know, in the popular culture, people think that food allergies are very, very common. So there have been surveys that have been done in the United States where there are polls that have been taken, and people think that maybe up to 20% of the population thinks that they have some expression of a food allergy. And, you know, when, and this gets sometimes stimulated by stories in the news that you hear from time to time. I remember maybe 4 or 5 years ago, a report that was that came out of a couple that was honeymooning in the Caribbean, and the couple was having a dinner at a restaurant or seafood restaurant. The woman happened to be allergic to shrimp. Someone was served a lobster that was boiled, and the fumes of that lobster wafted over to this couple. This woman had a severe allergic reaction and died. And so this was had widespread attention in the media, and I remember our prescriptions for epinephrine auto-injectors skyrocketed. So these kinds of stories and the notion that, you know, food allergies can cause a myriad of medical problems and behavioral problems is really very widespread. And it kind of goes in along with the notion that we've actually seen an increase in prevalence of food allergies in the United States and actually globally. And this is parallel with the increase in prevalence for a lot of other allergic diseases that I see, asthma, allergic rhinitis, anaphylaxis. All of these illnesses have shot up in terms of the prevalence. When you actually look at the statistics, though, from a medical perspective, people presenting to institutions, medical providers, and the like, the prevalence of food allergies is about 6% of the population. That represents about 20 million Americans. It's a little bit higher in children, about 8%, and it peaks in the first 1 to 3 years of life, and then tapers off as we go through middle school age and later teenage years, and levels off after age 18 to a prevalence about 2 to 4% in the adult population. So there's some sobering statistics about food allergy, too, that makes this such an important topic to talk about in that these can be very serious reactions, and we'll talk about the nature of those reactions in a moment. But about 30,000 ER visits are accounted for because of food allergic reactions, about 2,000 hospitalizations, and the most sobering statistic is about 150 people who actually die from food allergic reactions, much like that woman I just talked about before. And that's probably an underreporting of deaths due to food reactions, to food allergic reactions. A lot of so-called sudden death reactions attributed to cardiovascular disease, heart attacks, and so forth. Many people think that a lot of these reactions are related to anaphylactic reactions, some of which may be related to food.
Mark, can you just describe what anaphylactic reaction means to the audience? Because I know it's a great big word, but can you just describe what that means to the patient who has an anaphylactoid reaction?
Right. So anaphylaxis is a true medical emergency, and this is an immediate severe allergic reaction that happens to exposure to otherwise a harmless substance, a food, a drug, you know, an insect sting that to many people, they would have exposures to these things and have no adverse reaction. But to the susceptible individual, they can have a very fulminant, quick response, usually within minutes, maybe a little bit later, an hour or so, to an exposure that produces a myriad of symptoms. But in the case of anaphylaxis, there's at least two end organ systems that are involved. Most of the time, 90% of the time, people have reactions in their skin, typical things like hives, flushing, swelling, deeper swelling in the skin called angioedema. And they have another end organ involvement, either GI, where they have abdominal pain, distension, diarrhea. Women sometimes can get severe menstrual cramps or even labor-type pains. And the most serious thing can involve the cardiovascular system, where people can actually become hypotensive and go into shock and ultimately die if they're not really quickly remedied with appropriate medications.
So, Mark, can you fill in the audience about an EpiPen? Just what does that do, and should people have that?
Sure. So an EpiPen is a brand name of a class of drugs called epinephrine auto-injectors. So there are generic versions of the EpiPen, and there's another brand name called AviQ, which is a more conveniently packaged epinephrine product that actually talks to you as you're trying to administer it to yourself. So it's adrenaline. It's a medicine that kind of can reverse an anaphylactic reaction. This is the first-line antidote for any severe allergic food reaction, and we have every patient that we see who's had a serious food allergy or has the potential of a serious food reaction to have this on hand at all times. This is a life-saving medication. So it's easily accessible by most formularies, and it's something that definitely can save lives.
So, Mark, someone gets an EpiPen, and then they open it up when they're getting sweaty, shaky, their blood pressure seems to be falling. What do they do with that EpiPen? Is it hard to use?
It's not hard to use. I mean, the one product that I just mentioned, AviQ, actually has embedded in it an audio that once you activate it, it talks you through the entire mechanism. So it's kind of like the defibrillators that we have all over the place, that if somebody has a heart attack and you just pull the pads up, the machine automatically talks to you, tells you exactly what to do. This is this particular device. The other devices, which are not audio connected, are easy to use. You need to be trained on it, and it takes you know, just a minute to be trained in a medical office, or you can just go to YouTube and you can look at a video. And I, every time I see someone who has an EpiPen, I re-educate them, tell them about the YouTube, show them, demonstrate them. So it's really quite easy to do. You basically just pull the top off, inject it into your thigh. It can go through clothing. It's very easy to administer. Unfortunately, people, you know, sometimes have a phobia about doing this, and that sometimes impedes the acute administration of this important remedy when somebody's having a fulminant reaction. So we try to educate people to get people comfortable with doing this in the event that ever they need to use it.
So does an EpiPen die out in terms of how long it has a shelf life or how long someone can have it without getting a new one?
Yes, there is a shelf life, and there's a date on each epinephrine auto-injector. In the EpiPens themselves, the brand name EpiPen, there's actually a little window that you can see, and as the drug ages, it discolors and becomes yellow. So if you look at the window and it's clear and transparent, you know your product is good. Now, what most people don't know is that the FDA actually has stated that the expiration of the of any of the epinephrine auto-injectors extend by 6 months from the expiration date listed. So, for instance, if you have a an injector that says January 2025, that adrenaline injector actually lasts until July 1 of 25.
Excellent,
so it's important to keep these things in mind.
As always, Mark, on top of the game. So can you just move forward a second? How does a patient develop food allergies, and what's the final definition of a food allergy?
Okay. So this is fascinating. You know, to step back a moment, just think about this, Joe. The average American adult eats about a ton or 2,200 pounds of food a year. I mean, you can gain 10 pounds just thinking about that, right? and it's amazing to me that with all that food exposure, which is foreign substances, and this is what people develop allergic reactions to, foreign substances, and foods consist of, you know, protein, carbohydrate, fat, water, minerals, vitamins, fiber, and you can react to any one of those things short of water. And yet, we don't constantly walking around having allergic food reactions. Why is that? Well, our bodies have evolved in a very sophisticated way so that we're able to develop oral tolerance to most of the things that we eat. In fact, the vast majority of the things that we eat. Even for someone who has a food allergy to, let's say, peanuts, 99% of the food that they eat, they don't have allergic reactions to. So we have this ton of exposure to foods, and through mechanisms involving, you know, gastric digestive enzymes, development of specialized lymphocytes in the GI tract, and antibodies against food antigens, all these mechanisms allow us to eat food and prevent the absorption of food in an allergic fashion. And the situation where people develop allergy is a genetically programmed predisposition to developing, in many cases, an allergic antibody, which we call IgE, or immunoglobulin E. So this is a antibody that people develop to particular proteins in food, or to drugs, or to insect stings and the like. And what happens is this IgE is the bridge between the allergic protein in the food and cells in your body called mast cells, M-A-S-T. So these cells, just to go down the path of a little bit of biology, which I think is important to go over, these cells live they're kind of sentinel cells. They live at the interface between our bodies and the outside environment. So we see mast cells in our respiratory tract, our GI tract, and the skin. And when people have mast cell activation, like in the respiratory tract, they can have allergies in the upper airway or asthma in the lower airway. They can have GI activation with foods and have gut symptoms like abdominal pain, diarrhea, distension, or they can have skin reactions where they get hives and swelling. So the development of IgE to particular foods is what gets people into trouble and puts them at risk for developing clinically significant allergic reactions to foods.
So, Mark, how does the mast cells work? Do they all of a sudden explode and let out their innards, which are very toxic to the human? How do mast cells work?
So, yeah, actually, that's exactly how they work, Joe. So they get activated by a variety of medicines, a variety of ways. The most important is through this IgE connection. So this IgE antibody binds to a particular allergen and sits on the cell receptor. There are IgE receptors on mast cells that then, when the IgE binds to the receptors, it activates the mast cell, and there's preformed chemicals within the mast cell that are just ready to be released, things like histamine. And this is one of the most important vasoactive mediators that are released in allergic reactions. That's why people take antihistamines for allergic reactions. You know, we're all genetically programmed to know to take Benadryl if we have an allergic reaction. I don't know how that happens, but everybody knows that if you have an allergic reaction, you reach for Benadryl. And that's because these mast cells release histamine and other chemicals. And there are also other chemicals that are then stimulated to form, which get released maybe several hours after the initial activation of the mast cells, like prostaglandins, et cetera. So there's a myriad of chemicals that can be newly synthesized as well as immediately released.
So the body really gets upset about these guys, and it doesn't let go. So you're saying that you can overcome the original. So if you give an epi shot and it gets better, should that patient go to the hospital after that episode if they had very low blood pressure and were terrible and looked just not themselves? Should they go to the hospital because the mast cells keep leaking for a while, or is it just a short-term burst?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Joe. So what I tell people is their first line of therapy is to take epinephrine. They also concomitantly can take Benadryl or an oral steroids, which have an effect later than the onset of action of the epinephrine. So oftentimes people mistakenly just take Benadryl, or they even go to an urgent care in an ER and they just get Benadryl and steroids, when in reality they should be taking Benadryl they should be taking adrenaline for these very severe reactions to prevent the anaphylactic shock and so forth that really can get people into trouble. So if you take epinephrine as part of your treatment at home, I tell people that they should go to the emergency room. Oftentimes, they will feel much better within 15, 20 minutes. If they feel like they need to have that epinephrine repeated, then they can register. So they can actually sit in their car, sit in the waiting room, not necessarily register. They can wait there for an hour or so, and if they're free of symptoms most of the time, they don't actually need to be seen by a physician or doctor. But just in case they have that persistence of symptoms that comes back, they're ready to go and be seen in a medical facility that can take care of a really fulminant reaction.
Okay, Mark, I think there should be a Goldstein wait-and-see spot for cars close to the ER. How's that?
That sounds great.
I think they should put your name on it, too, because you're going to save a bunch of lives, and it's going to save the country money because, you know, you don't want to go in if you don't need it, but if you need it, let's move it. So, So can you just give us, again, symptoms of a food allergy?
Yeah. So food allergic reactions, first, are, again, oftentimes very immediate. I mean, within minutes of eating a food that you're allergic to, people can have a myriad of different kinds of symptoms. And I mentioned some of these before, the different end organs that can occur that can be affected are the skin. So people typically can have hives, they can have deeper swelling of the skin where you can see it in the lips, where the lips kind of balloon out. There can be severe puffiness around the eyes. This is called angioedema. Oftentimes people are extremely itchy. They can just have a flushing reaction is part of an allergic reaction as well, or just a flat rash that they experience. A very important symptom that is oftentimes the hallmark of a more serious anaphylactic reaction to occur minutes later is itching in the palms and itching in the soles. So if you eat a food and all of a sudden you find yourself scratching your hands and scratching your feet, and you just pass it off as an innocent kind of feeling and don't necessarily have swelling at the time, in a few minutes, that's going to escalate into much more serious reactions. So I tell people who have experienced food allergies about this particular symptom, and they need to get their medicines out, get ready to go, have that adrenaline available in the event that symptoms advance and you start therapy immediately. So that's the skin. In the GI tract, people can have, again, lip swelling. If you go from the mouth down to the rectum, lip swelling, tongue swelling, they can have itching in their palate. They can have swelling of the uvula. As you go further down in the GI tract, people can have abdominal distension, vomiting, nausea, pelvic pain, as I mentioned previously. And sometimes this is the only isolated set of symptoms that they get. They could just have a food allergy, just GI confined, just affecting the GI symptom system without any other systemic manifestations, which is why I see a lot of people who have had histories of inflammatory bowel disease or irritable bowel more commonly, and they've kind of been passed off by the GI doctors as just having this, you know, intolerance to food, when in fact they may in fact have an occult food allergy. The respiratory tract can be involved. This is usually part of a more generalized presentation. It's rare for someone to just get nose or eye symptoms or even just chest symptoms. The one example as an exception I like to point out is Baker's asthma. So there are people who are allergic to the flour and wheat, and if you handle flour and it gets aerosolized into lungs and you inhale it, you can develop an asthma attack from that. So that's a form of food allergy. And if you eat that wheat, sometimes people can eat the wheat as it's processed and cooked and don't have any symptoms, but the inhalation of the raw flour can provoke just respiratory symptoms alone. And then there's the cardiovascular symptoms that we talked about, where people can become hypotensive, they drop their blood pressure, that may make them very dizzy, get lightheaded, even faint, lose consciousness. Sometimes people, as they go down the throes of this really severe drop in blood pressure, there's a decrease in blood flow to vital organs. People have had seizures, heart attacks, etc. And these are the kinds of things that fall into this anaphylactic picture, where you have more than one end organ system involved, a very serious reaction, a medical emergency that needs immediate attention.
Okay, Mark, I'm glad I'm not an allergist. It would seem that some people sitting in your waiting room may be coming close to being on the ground with a need for CPR. So I'm sticking with endocrine. All right.
You're missing a lot of fun, though, Joe.
Oh, yeah, my rear end. You got to be kidding. When people have that coding process, that's not fun. So, and of course, it's just amazing that you've got that capability to reverse those kind of things. So it's nice to be in the allergist office if you're going to have one of those episodes. I recommend it. I'll give Mark's address out, and everybody who's going to get close, he can be ready to go. Just kidding. So how can food affect the skin? Just got to ask you that question, because we're taking something going in the mouth and the skin is getting mad. What's cooking there?
Yeah, so again, this is probably the most common form of food allergy involves the skin. When people, and most of the food allergy reactions that people experience are really not even reported. So, for instance, if you eat shrimp and all of a sudden within 2 or 3 minutes you're getting hives, well, it's very clear to that individual that they're having an allergic reaction. And again, they're genetically encoded to take Benadryl. Somehow people know to do that, and they take Benadryl, and their symptoms go away. And they never see a medical provider. They never get additional treatment. and they just pass it off as a one-off thing. So that's the most common thing, and then the deeper swelling called angioedema, and then flushing reactions can occur. Food allergies can also be involved in atopic dermatitis, which is a chronic relapsing disease of the skin, very itchy. People get red, scaly rashes and patches. The distribution varies upon the age of the individual. Food allergies are a very significant trigger in a lot of children. Maybe about 50-60% of kids who have atopic dermatitis have foods that really are behind this the activation of eczema. And it goes beyond just the IgE-mediated response to foods that cause these reactions. But nevertheless, foods can be very profoundly involved in the pathogenesis. And food skin testing is very helpful in identifying those kinds of individuals, and going on an elimination diet has been really amazing in some kids in terms of just eliminating, let's say, food like egg or milk and dramatically reversing their eczema. And that's usually part of what needs to be done in kids because, again, this is a relapsing condition and there's other factors that can be involved. There's other interesting food allergy skin reactions. There are some people who get a contact hive reaction on touching raw food. There are people that tell me all the time they have problems handling like raw shrimp or handling raw potatoes or raw meat, and there's an immediate reaction that they experience on their skin. And it's interesting, when those foods are cooked or processed, they don't usually have problems eating them, but handling the raw material, they can get an immediate reaction. We also see this in food handlers, butchers, fishermen who are handling, you know, fish or raw meat and so forth. Over time, they develop a chronic contact dermatitis of the skin, and that's treated a little bit differently, and the identification of the food allergens can be done through patch testing rather than prick skin testing of the skin, because there's a different immune mechanism. But nevertheless, people experience similar kinds of itching and develop chronic changes in their skin, as opposed to people just have the immediate contact reaction where it's a one-and-done thing. You wash your hands, you take some medicine, and your skin goes back to normal. And then the other interesting skin manifestation of food allergies is dermatitis herpetiformis, which is not it's another immune-mediated food reaction, not IgE-mediated food reaction, and it's the skin manifestation of celiac disease. So this gets us to talk a little bit about celiac disease, which is seen in about 1% of the population. And this is an immune-mediated reaction to gliadin, which is found in flour like, you know, wheat, barley, rye, and others, and can cause in the gut abdominal pain and cramping, flatulence, diarrhea, and so forth. But it can also have gastrointestinal manifestations like the skin disease dermatitis herpetiformis, which is a very itchy, blistery reaction, usually occurs on the skin. It's a chronic condition and responds, as does celiac disease in general, to restriction of gliadin in the diet. So that's very effective. And you can easily test for this in the blood, or sometimes people have to get an upper endoscopy and get a biopsy of their gut or a skin biopsy if they have the skin manifestation. So a very treatable disease, simply avoiding gliadin or gluten in the diet. Used to be very difficult to do that. Now there's lots of options with foods that are gluten-free, so it's a lot easier for people who have this kind of problem.
So, Mark, how often do you see that in your office? Because it seems to me like it's kind of hard to get to the bottom of that. I mean, you're an expert, but how often do you see that in your office?
I see probably about 10 cases of dermatitis herpetiformis each year. People just present with this kind of itchy, chronic skin condition. It has a very characteristic appearance. I see people who have concerns about wheat or gluten sensitivity a lot. Again, these are people who oftentimes get passed off as having irritable bowel syndrome. And it's interesting, there's kind of three things people can have in regard to gliadin or gluten sensitivity. They can have a wheat allergy where they actually truly develop an IgE antibody to the wheat, the gluten product, or they can have celiac disease, which is, again, this non-IgE immune-mediated reaction that has systemic manifestations. And that can be a very serious disease if it's not recognized. I mean, it can lead to other kinds of complications, including osteoporosis and the skin disease that I mentioned. And then people who don't have celiac disease and don't have wheat allergy have basically a kind of what I call a non-celiac gluten intolerance, where they just have a digestive issue with eating gluten products. And I think probably the vast majority of people who have problems with wheat actually fall into that category. But it's an important distinction to make, because that illness is not a systemic disease, and it's not associated with these other extra gastrointestinal manifestations.
So, Mark, I just want to cut in for a little bit of a different switch here now. I want to tell everybody, you can tell everybody, that you have a fantastic source that people can hit their computer every morning and decide what's high, ragweed, whatever. Can you tell everybody about the service that your group provides that's available online every morning?
Sure. So we do the pollen counts for Metropolitan Philadelphia. We've been doing this for over 30-some years, and several years ago, actually in 2020, we switched over from a manual technique of looking at slides that were prepared on collections of air samples for 24 hours to an automated system using artificial intelligence for identifying pollen and mold spores. So we do real-time pollen mold reporting, and what we do, we have a sampler device in our office in Center City on the top of the rooftop of that building, does a collection, takes digital photos, which gets uploaded to a server that has a database of pictures of pollen and mold spores, and actually identifies what's in the air in our area. And this can be done real-time, and we report this out every day around between 6 and 8 a.m. in the morning. So people, if they click on our website, they can immediately see our pollen count on the left-hand corner. The Asthma Center website is asthmacenter.com. And we do this service between early March through the middle part of November. And the other feature that we've added, which I think is particularly important now, is we also are publishing the EPA air quality, because as you probably are aware, the air quality over the past 2 weeks has really been a problem with the increase in ozone levels and particulate matters. And this also represents a huge hazard for people who have respiratory diseases. And people, even if the levels get high enough, to people who otherwise have normal respiratory tracts and just have difficulty inhaling a lot of pollutants in the air. So again, the Asthma Center website is asthmacenter.com, and you can subscribe to the service where we can email this daily report every day as well for convenience.
And Mark, that's been going on how long?
So using the artificial intelligence technology has been for the past 4 years. And this is really the way of doing this, because this gives real-time data, whereas in the past, what we would be reporting is what the pollen count was for the past 24 hours. So people, you know, much like the weather, you want to know what's happening now and what's going to happen the next 24 hours, not what happened yesterday. So this allows you to really get a sense of what's in the air now, how you can plan your day, should you be outside, should you be inside, and I think it's very, very helpful to get a sense of what's in the air from an environmental pollen point of view, mold point of view, and now the air quality as well.
All right, so I think moms who have kids should know that site too, just to make sure those kids are healthy and stay healthy and don't get an allergic reaction. So do you want to talk about red meat allergy at all, or do you want to...
Yeah.
Okay, fire away. What is red meat allergy?
Okay, Joe, so I know this is your favorite food allergy topic. So yes, we have talked about this before, and there's some nuances that I want to share with you as well. But just to go back to basics, you know, this was first described in 2009 in a group of 24 individuals that were observed at the University of Virginia who had reported typical food allergic reactions of hives, swelling reactions, even anaphylaxis, abdominal pain, and they occurred oftentimes in the early morning. People woke up at night and having these fulminant reactions, which is very atypical for food allergy in general, because what I've been describing to you in our discussion with anaphylaxis is usually people, if it's a food, they're going to eat this food, and within minutes to an hour, they're going to have this fulminant reaction. Well, this was not the case. People were asleep. They're waking up, you know, 4 or 5 hours after their last meal and having these reactions. And it turns out that they went back and tried to find some commonality with these people, and they figured out that these people had red meat for dinner and had these relayed reactions. And eventually, through a very interesting story, I won't go into the details, they recognized, and these are people, by the way, who previously could eat red meat without any problems. This occurred mainly in adults, but 12% of the people who have alpha-gal were actually kids. But in any event, all these people had a history of a tick bite from a tick called the that has a Lone Star. It's called the Lone Star tick, and this is different than the deer tick that causes Lyme's disease. And it's an indigenous to southeastern United States. But I can tell you that even in 2009, it was in New Jersey, because I had a patient who, this was probably around 2005, who presented to me with, again, a classic history where he woke up in the middle of the night after he had eaten hamburger. And I had no idea why this happened. He didn't have any immediate reaction to hamburger, and that was the only meat that he ate. And this happened multiple times, so we knew this was a true thing. So then this story comes out in 2009, and 5 years later, and I track this patient down, bring him back in, test him for alpha-gal, which is simply a blood test, and lo and behold, this is what he had. And he lived in an area where there was a lot of woods around his home, would oftentimes go hiking, and he obviously had tick bites and developed this alpha-gal syndrome. So it's this tick bite that now has actually migrated even more to the northeast part of the United States because of warmer climates, and it's very common. And in some counties in New Jersey, there's probably more tick bites from the Lone Star tick than the deer tick that causes Lyme's disease. And so what's happening is here is there is a sugar in the saliva of the tick that people develop an IgE antibody. And that sugar is present in non-primate mammalian meat, as well as other mammalian products. So people get sensitized to this sugar. And then the interesting thing, again, it's not an immediate reaction, but it's a delayed reaction, oftentimes occurring 3 to 6 hours after consumption of red meat like beef, pork, or lamb. It could occur with if you eat venison, goat, rabbit, squirrel, buffalo, and even organ meats. And now some of the nuances of this is that there are some people who will have of a more immediate reaction. Maybe 10% of people have a more of immediate reaction, similar to what we think about in terms of the standard food allergy, which is why when I see people who come in with just a history of anaphylaxis or hives or even just isolated abdominal pain, I'm testing them for alpha-gal syndrome. And by the way, the blood test for alpha-gal is for this allergy antibody to galactose alpha-1 galactose. That's what the alpha-gal is kind of the short name for. And it's very important to actually list that sugar, because oftentimes the people drawing blood, if there's a blood draw for alpha-gal, they'll do another test for a enzyme called alpha-galactosidase, which is associated with a genetic disease called Fabry's disease. And this happens either once or twice a year, where I send off a test for alpha-gal, and they do this other test for this genetic disorder, and we got to do it all over again. So make sure the ordering provider orders the right test, galactose alpha-1-3 galactose IgE. So these people develop this allergy antibody, and the natural history of this we're still learning about. So it's thought that perhaps people who over time, maybe 4 to 5 years after their initial exposure, will... You there?
I'm here.
Okay, good. I'm sorry I lost the connection. So 4 or 5 years, if they go through a period of time where they don't have any additional tick bites, to resensitize them, they actually may lose their sensitivity to red meat allergy. So we establish this by yearly following people's titers to alpha-gal, and if they get to a point where they have negligible titers below the normal threshold, we'll do food challenges and see if we can reintroduce a red meat into their diet. And now, as of February of this year, we have this other product, which we can talk about in a moment, called Xolair, that can also be used to treat alpha-gal and get people back to maybe a life that includes red meat, which is oftentimes really missed in a lot of people.
So, Mark, I have a patient who I just saw in the office about a week ago. He's been diagnosed with this alpha-gal, and this guy's lost like 100 pounds. Before he was overweight, now he's not overweight. But he basically just seems to have a lot of symptoms that are above and beyond what he started out with. What's the natural history of somebody who has alpha-gal and doesn't get treated? I mean, what do they look like? What do they feel like? You know, why would they come to somebody like you, and can you help me out?
Yeah, so there are people that definitely have chronic symptoms because, you know, it's this sugar can also be in other kinds of products, you know, in foods, other foods. It can be found in drugs, personal hygiene products. So just to give you, you know, a couple examples, foods that are cooked, let's say, in a pork lard has a high content of alpha-gal. So you're not eating the red meat, but the lard has this sugar in it, and so people may be getting exposure from foods cooked with a high food content from lard. There could be a gelatin additive in food or even gelatin capsules in which, you know, medicines are packaged in. That source of gelatin could be beef or it could be pork. Alpha-gal can sometimes be in other medications. In your field, Joe, I don't know if you're aware, but the natural thyroid hormone armor is derived from pig thyroid glands. And so I've seen two people who had reactions to armor thyroid because of alpha-gal syndrome. So they're taking this thyroid medicine every day, not realizing that they have this alpha-gal syndrome. So sometimes it can be subtle as well. So you kind of really need to kind of call through what people are taking, not only in terms of avoiding red meat, but are they have any other additives that could potentially have mammalian derived products in. So it takes a very careful history to kind of sort it out.
Well, I am glad that you hunted down that patient years ago, and I'm glad that you're in the business right now. You want to switch a little bit up to tick bites? Maybe that's less invasive.
So, you know, certainly this, you know, we're right now at kind of the height of the tick season. So ticks in our area are very, very prevalent from April through October. I mean, they're present all year round, but this is really the time when people have, the most intense exposure to ticks. And as I said, deer tick, which is the black leg tick that commonly causes Lyme disease, is a problem in our area, as well as increasingly the Lone Star tick that causes alpha-gal. So yeah, there's a couple things that, you know, you can do to try to decrease your exposure to ticks. I think what I'll do is list these things on our website if people want to look at it later on next week. But clearly, it's important for people who go outdoors, who do hiking, gardening, and so forth, that they be careful about, you know, sources of where ticks may hang out, like in, you know, collections of decaying leaves and other vegetation. Even soil can have ticks. It's important to wear light-colored clothing, which will not attract ticks. Clothing that's actually particularly tightly woven can also kind of be a physical barrier. It's important to wear long pants, long sleeves, tuck your pants into your socks or your boots. Wearing a insect repellent is very, very helpful, and the product that I increasingly use is a 20% Bicaridin solution. It can be sprayed on. It has efficacy that lasts for about 8 to 10 hours. It's equivalent in efficacy to 30% DEET, which is also very effective, but DEET is sometimes difficult to wear. It's a little greasy. It can affect clothing, whereas the 20% picaridin solution does not. There are clothing that's actually impregnated with a natural insect repellent called pyrethrum, which is derived from chrysanthemums. People can buy clothing that has this in it, or they can buy pyrethrum and spray it on their clothing. And those kinds of things, I think, go a long way in terms of reducing your risk of getting a tick bite. And certainly, if you see ticks, you should remove them with tweezers, clean the area with alcohol, soap, and water. For alpha-gal, one of these ticks needs to be on your body for minimally 4 hours, and you can get alpha-gal. For Lyme disease, it's said that, you know, a deer tick that's infected has to be on your skin for at least 24 hours. So it's very important to inspect your skin after you go outside and you're in one of these high-exposure areas. And also check your pets, too, because your pets can be carriers of ticks as well.
Okay. So let's just move it to the shore time. It's summertime. And do you have to deal with seafood allergies often?
Oh, all the time. I mean, basically, because seafood allergy is probably the most common cause of food allergy in adults. So I see a lot of people who have had allergic reactions to, you know, shrimp, crab, lobster, that sort of thing. So let's just talk about definitions. What is seafood? So seafood comprises basically three groups. One is fish, bony fish that have a vertebrae, you know, things like salmon, tuna, tilapia, cod. The common allergen is called para-ovalbumin, which is present in all of these bony fish. And so there's a lot of cross-reactivity between fish. So if you're reactive to one fish, it's not uncommon to have reactions to another. And then there's the crustacean group that's included in seafood, and that includes shrimp, prawn, crab, lobster, crawfish. And then the third group is the mollusks, and these are the bivalve species like scallops, clams, oysters, mussels. It also includes squid and snail. So when we use the term shellfish, shellfish basically includes the crustaceans and the mollusks, and those are the things that cause most of the allergic reactions that I see. So the crustaceans, shrimp, crab, lobster, the common antigen, well, there's several different antigens, but the most common is a tropomycin, which is what most of the commercial extracts that we use for skin testing and for blood testing use as the antigen to which we're defining an allergic antibody to. So it's very interesting with shrimp, crab, and lobster allergies. So somebody oftentimes will come into my office and they will have a history of, you know, immediately having hives. They had no previous problem eating shellfish allergy, eating shrimp or crab or lobster, and then they go out to dinner and boom, they have a reaction. So what is that all about? So we, in the process of evaluating people, we'll skin test them. And if their skin test positive, we know they have this IgE antibody. And in many cases, this is something that is, turns out to be usually a lifelong problem. Certainly with children, there are some foods like peanuts and tree nuts that are lifelong. Once you develop a sensitivity at an early age, you usually have this lifelong. And for many adults who develop all of a sudden the shellfish sensitivity, they will have this lifelong. So the people are very easy to handle. Their skin test positive. And up until, you know, this year, the treatment was basically avoidance, being careful about cross-reactivity with other shelf crustaceans. So if you're allergic to shrimp, you have a little bit greater chance of having reactions to crab and lobster, but not necessarily always the case. So, for instance, if I see somebody who's just shrimp allergic, but they've recently eaten lobster and crab, and even if their skin tests positive, that person can eat the crab and the lobster, but they just need to avoid the shrimp. there are people who have, the classic history, hives after eating shrimp, and their skin tests are negative. So what's that all about? So sometimes that's related to the fact that shrimp, particularly if they're left out and not frozen immediately, and they can spoil a little bit, can develop a high histamine content. This is, can be a degradation product from the muscle as it decomposes. And if you're sensitive enough to the ingestion of histamine, you can have a reaction that mimics an allergic reaction. So it's kind of like a pharmacologic reaction and relates to the freshness of the fish, not to a true allergy. It's kind of like, you know, when people say they're allergic to, or have reactions to coffee, they get insomnia or they get jumpy or jittery to the caffeine. It's not because they're allergic to the coffee. It's because they're having a pharmacologic reaction to the caffeine. Not everybody has this pharmacologic reaction, but there's some people who are very sensitive to it, and they will have these kinds of reactions. So, too, if you eat enough histamine and spoiled shrimp, you can have what looks like an allergic reaction. And so the next time you eat it, and if you eat fresh shrimp, you may not have a reaction. So that's another scenario. And then there are people, and this is really very interesting, who maybe skin test negative to shrimp, but they're very skin test reactive to dust mite. So what's that all about? So there's a common allergen that exists between some arthropods, insects like dust mite, crickets, cockroaches, that people get very commonly sensitized and produce respiratory allergy. And this set of allergens cross-react with minor allergens that are in shrimp. So people are very sensitive to dust mite. When they eat shrimp, as if their immune system thinks they're eating dust mite, and they have a reaction. And that can explain why some people have these reactions, but don't show skin test reactivity on skin testing or blood testing. And then the last thing that can happen, which is less common, is there sometimes is a parasite in fish and in shellfish called Anisakis, and people can develop an allergy to that parasite. And so if you eat shrimp that's infected with this, and you can test for this parasite or this allergy that's parasite in the blood, they can have an allergic reaction. So there's all kinds of different scenarios how some people can end up manifesting clinical symptoms, and it's important to sort these things out because in some cases this is a lifelong reaction that they need to be very careful about, avoid, carry adrenaline, maybe consider this drug Xolair. And then others where it may be a one-off reaction just due to a contamination issue.
So, Professor Goldstein, you have to just sum up and tell us where you work, tell us if you have any partners, give us any advice, make sure you can give a little summary on when they can get to your website for what you do every day in the morning. Can you just give us a little update there, Mark, because I hate to have you go without getting that information out to our audience.
Okay. So our practice, the Asthma Center, has four locations, one in Mount Laurel, Center City, Northeast Philadelphia, and Langhorne, Pennsylvania. All the sites can be accessed through our website, asthmacenter.com, or our central telephone number, 215-569-1111. I work with two other excellent clinicians, Dr. Irene Howard-Labatis and Dr. Nancy Gordon, as well as two mid-level providers, Nancy Rexer and Lauren Woodward. And we have really a great team, and we're happy to see people with all kinds of food-related problems. We didn't talk about Xolair, which is really the new revolutionary product that has really changed how we can treat food allergies by protecting people with this immune shield of this biologic drug. It's very, very effective, and it was approved in February of 2024. And so people who have food sensitivities, food allergies, may be candidates for this this fantastic drug, very safe. We've used it for several years for asthma, and now is approved for food allergies.
So, Mark, but you're also centered for University of Penn. Where in Philadelphia?
So, yeah. So, in Center City, Philadelphia, on Broad and Ray Streets, across what used to be Hahnemann University, three streets north of City Hall, where Billy Penn lives on the top of City Hall. And, yeah, so that's our Center City location. That's our main central administrative hub, and I work out of that office 2 days a week.
Fantastic. So Mark, just give me a sense. How much reading do you have to do a night? Because you've given us so much information. I really appreciate it. And just why don't you just hit that Zolaire just a little bit more importantly, because you said we have about 2 minutes left.
So, you know, what I've said is an accumulation of experience, training, and knowledge that I've accumulated over many, many years of practice. And and I do try to keep up to date and read, and it's fascinating to me, and it's very helpful for the patients that that I treat. And so, too, is this drug, Xolair, which, again, was first approved in 2003 for asthma, very safe, very successful, used also for treatment of chronic hives and chronic rhinosinusitis with polyps, and now for food allergies. It's an expensive medication, has to be pre-authorized, and as you know, Joe, the insurance companies don't want to approve it, but we fight for people, and it really can really change people's lives because, you know, it's easy to say avoid a food. To do that is really a huge inconvenience. It places a lot of burden, decreases quality of life. Food reactions cause a lot of anxiety and fear in people. And having the protection of this allergic kind of umbrella shield that I call of Xolair really kind of makes people who have lived with food anxiety from food allergies a lot more easier situation. In many cases, people have gone on to eat the foods that they previously have reacted to, which is not what is stated to do in the package insert. It's really to prevent accidental exposures to foods that people are allergic to.
Dr. Mark Goldstein, Professor Goldstein, thank you for being on. University of Pennsylvania loves you, and so do the patients of New Jersey and Philly. We'll be back next week. Thank you, Dr. Mark Goldstein.
Thank you, Joe.
Philadelphia home.